This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dowty, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the corner of the metaverse where you, me, and the top experts get together to understand a big issue of the day. This week, as the West responds to the Russian invasion of Ukraine with sanctions, we're asking how successful those sanctions are likely to be. This morning, Russia launched a full-on invasion of its neighbour, Ukraine. Military action against Russia by the West and its allies in this eventuality has never been an option. So far, the weapon chosen to punish or achieve a reverse in Russian aggression is economic and other sanctions. So, how far can sanctions go? Who would suffer? And would they be likely to succeed? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. Before we examine how specific sanctions might work against Russia, how have they worked against other countries in the past? Lee Jones is Professor of International Politics at Queen Mary, University of London. Lee Jones, when people talk about sanctions and whether they're successful, people usually point to the case of South Africa and the sanctions that were imposed on them to bring an end to apartheid. Before we go on to whether or not they were successful, what sort of sanctions actually were they?
Quite a lot of different kinds. So in the 1960s, there was a voluntary arms embargo, and then that was widened to a mandatory one from 1977. And then from the 1960s to the 70s, there was a tightening oil embargo. And then in the mid-80s, the UN Security Council called for voluntary embargoes covering a whole host of things: investment, transport links, gold coin sales, cultural and sporting ties. And a few states did impose comprehensive embargoes on almost all ties with South Africa.
And how long were those sanctions in place?
Well, decades in the case of the oil and arms embargoes. The tighter economic sanctions really only started to bite in the mid-1980s. And within, well, less than a decade, apartheid was gone.
OK, now the big question is what role sanctions actually played in the ending of that regime. What can we say about that?
Well, my research would suggest that they played a role, but it was a modest one. So, as we just said, there were decades of sanctions on South Africa, and the regime was able to withstand that, evade them, get around these sanctions, and displace the costs onto the domestic population. By the 1980s, there was a difference, two differences. One was that there was a structural economic crisis, which was really biting the regime hard. And secondly, there was mass organised opposition from the non-white majority, which was rendering South African cities ungovernable by the mid-1980s. And so the regime was trying to do two things at once. It was trying to suppress and manage the conflict using the coercive parts of the state. And then it was wanting to try to ameliorate the causes of the unrest. So, for example, invest in housing, education, job creation, that kind of thing. Now, in the condition of the economic crisis, it couldn't really do both at the same time. So insofar as sanctions sort of added to that, then it forced the regime to negotiate with the opposition and end apartheid.
Well, that's very interesting in the context of what a Ukrainian population might do in the situation of Russian occupation, I suppose. But let's go to other cases of the use of sanctions. Would you say that since the South African experience, sanctions have become a kind of go-to tool in international relations where countries are not willing to risk military operations?
Yeah, absolutely. So in the mid 20th century, only about five countries were subject to a sanctions regime. And by 2000, almost 50 countries were. So there was a massive explosion of sanctions through the late 1980s and especially the 90s.
Well, let's talk about a few of those, because other countries have faced long-running sanctions regimes. One thinks of Cuba in the case of America, particularly, and Myanmar.
So in the Cuban case, they have been subjected to a comprehensive American embargo since the early 60s, the longest running, most comprehensive sanctions regime in human history. And in the case of Myanmar, there were many different complex forms of sanctions, some of them sectoral, some of them financial, some of them targeted, from the late 1980s through to around about 2012.
Tell me what happened in the case of Cuba. What were the objectives that the United States had, and to what extent have the sanctions regime actually worked?
It's been a total failure. So if you think that the goal was regime change, then, you know, getting rid of Fidel Castro, well, we know Castro retired. He died peacefully and his successors remain in office. The regime continues. If the goal was to try to contain Cuba and stop it helping other authoritarian regimes like Venezuela, again, it had the opposite effect. You know, it forced Cuba into relations with those kinds of regimes. So it has just been a total failure.
Right. And what role would we say that sanctions played in the liberalisation in Myanmar before 2012?
Again, my research found that they didn't play any role. Lots of people argued that Myanmar was the South Africa of the 1990s, but there was a big difference in Myanmar that, first of all, it wasn't so exposed to Western economic ties. Secondly, the opposition forces there were much weaker relative to the military. And so the military was able to protect itself and its allies and deflect the costs of sanctions onto the broader population and actually become stronger over time. So the Myanmar economy actually increased. It expanded. Trade with Asian partners, investment from China and so on, just came in to fill any gaps left by the West. So you could take a set of sanctions that ostensibly seemed to work in a country like South Africa and then apply them to a different state. And even if you copied them exactly, they would have a completely different outcome. What matters is the domestic situation in the target state.
Right. So if what you're hoping is that sanctions may topple a regime or make it change course, how often would you estimate that sanctions can make a useful contribution to that objective?
Well, there is some dispute about this. There's sort of consensus in the literature from scholars that like to defend sanctions and say they are useful, is that they work roughly about 30% of the time. But some people who have looked at that more critically say the success rate is closer to 5%. Because in lots of the so-called success cases, the outcome that we're interested in, whether a change of policy or a change of regime, was actually produced by something else. And sanctions were just incidental to the outcome. And I think, broadly speaking, when you're thinking about sanctions, there has to be a plausible story that you can tell between imposing sanctions and getting the outcome that you want. And if you can't tell that causal story, you probably shouldn't be thinking of imposing sanctions.
Unless you want to do it for demonstrative reasons, because you feel the moral pull to do it.
Absolutely. And this is another interesting thing about sanctions, is we often think that there's only one goal, which is to coerce the target to do what you want. But there can also be sender-related goals, right? I can impose sanctions on you because I want to feel good. I want to demonstrate to my domestic population or domestic political critics that I'm doing something. You know, there's often a call, something must be done, this is something, therefore let us do it. So I might not necessarily have any hope of coercing you, but I want to show to somebody else that there are costs for doing what you're doing, and therefore I might want to deter them. So I'm trying to shore up an international system of rules, and it's not really about the target. It might be about me, it might be about the system.
Professor Lee Jones, and joining me now live in the briefing room to consider the impact of sanctions on Russia are Tom Keating, founding director of the Center for Financial Crime and Security Studies at RUSI, Dr. Maria Shagina, who is currently working with the Geneva International Sanctions Network, and Tyler Kustra, assistant professor of politics and international relations at Nottingham University. Tom Keating, let me ask you first. In the last few hours, the UK government has announced a major package of sanctions against Russia. What, in your mind, are the most significant ones?
Well, this is a major step up from the tokenistic announcements earlier in the week. So we have an asset freeze on all major Russian banks, including VTB, which is the second largest, a prohibition of Russian companies raising money in London, in UK markets, a list of 100 individuals and companies, including oligarchs, on the list. The ability of the Russian airline Aeroflot to land in the UK will be suspended. And a large number of exports sanctions on equipment for extracting oil and gas, high-tech and dual-use goods. And we're told a plan to work towards the sanctioning of SWIFT, or the removal of Russia from SWIFT.
So a plan to work towards it, but Only to work towards it because why? Other people are not yet sold on it?
Yes, I mean, SWIFT is a cooperative. It's based in the European Union. It is not within the UK's gift to shut Russia's access to SWIFT. SWIFT is a messaging system that allows banks to communicate across borders, and that will need all countries to agree if it's going to come to pass.
So essentially, it's a banking system.
It's a messaging system. It's a very efficient email system for a bank in one country to tell a bank in another country that they are going to do a transaction together.
Now, Maria Shagina, what have we heard so far from the EU?
We're still waiting from the EU about the second package of sanctions, but what we know so far from the statements from Brussels, we're talking about massive targeted sanctions that will weaken Russia's economic base to finance war. There will be a lot of coordination with measures that the UK government already announced and the US recently. So we're also talking about asset freezes of Russia's systemically important entities. Probably VTB Bank will also be there. Stopping access to the European financial market for the key Russian companies. Expert control on technology. The divisions within the EU are still there. So the lines where the EU countries could not agree is whether to include a SWIFT option that Tom just discussed. Some countries like Germany, Italy are still not keen on launching this option. And there are also divisions whether to sanction Putin directly.
Very briefly, why aren't they keen on doing something about SWIFT now?
SWIFT is still seen as this nuclear option, despite the fact that, as Tom said, this is a messaging system. But this is probably held in reserve for further Russia invasion in Ukraine.
Okay. Tyler Kustra, Joe Biden has been speaking just within the last couple of hours. What has he announced?
So the Americans already had a more comprehensive list of individuals, Russian individuals that were sanctioned than the UK. They've added a few of those to the list. They've added a few companies. They've said that they're going to restrict the ability of Russia to raise debt on the American capital markets. Very similar things to what we've all heard. And then Biden came out and he said, we're also going to prevent Russia from doing any international trade in dollars. And remember, over half of Russia's international trade is actually cleared through the U.S. financial system in dollars. And so I was very hopeful that that would mean we're going to get some really severe sanctions. But then Biden said, but it won't apply to energy. So I'm waiting to see the exact details, but I'm a little bit concerned here that there's nothing more the U.S. is going to do. If you're not going to sanction Russia's oil and gas trade, which represents over 50% of its exports, the U.S. isn't doing much more.
Tom, we heard earlier from Lee Jones the importance of knowing what your sanctions are supposed to achieve. Do we actually know what the objectives of sanctions are? Or are they just simply let Russia feel some pain?
I think initially the threat of massive economic consequences was meant to act as a deterrence. It was all about if you do this, you will be sanctioned. Clearly, Vladimir Putin has progressed. And now, in a way, we are focused on trying to deter him from going further. Will that be successful? We don't know. But then trying to change behavior. So I'm afraid that sanctions could have had their moment as a deterrent force. But that moment has sadly passed.
OK, now let's look at the impact upon Russia itself. Maria, as far as you can tell, what effect will these sanctions so far announced have on the Russian people?
We're in a situation where no surgical sanctions can be imposed to have this constraining effect to prevent further invasion in Ukraine. We're not talking about narrowly tailored sanctions. That means systemically important companies, banks, entities will be targeted. And that will inevitably reverberate through the whole Russian economy, which means Russian people will have their share to bear. But we are in the situation where there is a war at stake, and this is where we need to weigh our options.
Do you think that Russian people, when they begin to feel the problems as a result of sanctions, will blame their government, or will he be successful in making sure that the West gets the blame?
Since the Russian government controls propaganda domestically, that will be easy to divert the blame towards the West, the US in particular. But given that there is still a free internet in Russia, there could be still a way to send a message to the Russian people. And we saw the protests today throughout Russian cities that this is, you know, something serious happening and you need to protest against your government.
Marie, I've got to ask you about the oligarchs, not least because there was that bizarre meeting of Putin and the oligarchs, which was a photograph today. The idea is they get sanctioned. They don't like him very much as a result of it, so they do something about it or put pressure on him. So I'm bound to ask this, who owns who in Russia? Do the oligarchs own Putin or does Putin own them?
It's a mutually beneficial system in Russia. Oligarchs get their key strategic positions in companies and strategic sectors because government allows them to have it. And in return, the government gets revenues from those companies, and there is a rent distribution within the system. So currently, oligarchs show a lot of loyalty. They suffer in silence. Today, we saw that the Russian stock market plummeted, but they are very unwilling and probably afraid to speak out loud. And they are prepared to toe the line, to show the loyalty and to protect the interest of the state.
So, in other words, for the time being, he owns them. Tyler Kustra, how far has Russia been preparing for this moment in terms of the sanctions it must surely have known would come?
I mean, it's been preparing since 2014 when it invaded Crimea and the Donbass, and we responded with sanctions. So it's been working to try to sanction-proof its economy. You know, the Russian government is currently running a surplus, so they don't need to raise debt abroad. The Russian government has tried to build an alternative to the SWIFT payment system, so they're, even if they were disconnected, they don't need it. That said, their alternative is not used by very many people. It's sort of like an American Express card over in Europe. People look at it as a very queer thing, and they're just like, I don't, you know, it would be very difficult to use it and transact with it. But they've built that, and they've also, of course, stocked up on foreign capital reserves so that in the event that the ruble starts to plummet, their central bank can try to prop it back up. That said, you know, devastating sanctions can only be held off for so long. And if we were to engage in very, very serious sanctions, then the Russian economy would feel it. And I should also note, by the way, that, I mean, the stock market was down 33% earlier today before they had to halt trading. Russian government debt, its value has plummeted by 20% because no one wants to hold it. And there's lineups at ATMs all over Russia. I mean, they are being hurt. They are feeling this.
Tom, will they be able to replace what the Europeans and what the Americans and allies have offered them and the relationship they had with relationships with other countries? I'm thinking here particularly about how China will be reacting to what's happened in Ukraine and what it then does.
As Tyler pointed out, you know, they've had 8 years to prepare for this moment. They've had a strategy of import substitution. And we've seen this in the past with other countries, for example, Iran, that have found themselves subject to heavy sanctions. You know, they have looked for alternative markets to source what they want. They may not want to go to those markets. They may think the quality is inferior. But this is a tried and tested way of operating. And so whilst it may be the case that they can't get everything that they need, I'm certainly sure that they will be working very hard with the Chinese and others to continue to get the kinds of goods and so on that they want to source.
And do you think China will oblige them?
The rhetoric coming from Beijing suggests that if they have to pick a side, they will certainly pick Moscow.
Okay. Now, Tom, let's look at the risk we face from our imposition of sanctions. And in the first instance, the kind of threat which there's been from Russia of sanction retaliation. What kind of retaliation, economic retaliation and sanction retaliation, could Russia impose on America, us, Europe?
I think the first thing to say is that if we want sanctions to be effective, given how closely integrated, particularly EU markets are with Russia, we have to accept a good degree of self-harm. Does that mean that the lights will go out in certain European countries because the energy gets switched off? Well, you know, we obviously hope not. But there are fertilizer exports. There are certain rare earths. I mean, there is certainly a lot that we rely on from Russia when it comes to our industry. So they have options to play with here for sure.
And let's talk about European dependency on Russian gas, Tom. This seems to be really central to the future relationship, economic relationship with Russia. Is it in their interest to turn off the tap?
It's difficult to say, isn't it? Because such, as Tyler mentioned, such an enormous part of their economy relies on this income. I mean, even during the Cold War period, you know, energy continued to flow. So I don't think it is a clear-cut decision for the Kremlin. We've obviously seen the Germans come forward and say that they're not going to certify Nord Stream 2. So that future stream of revenue looks as though it is dead for the time being. But I think there's an important message out of all of this, which is that as the Russians have focused on import substitution in recent years, unfortunately, actually the West hasn't. And we obviously have to learn a lesson from this.
Maria, can Russia sell its gas elsewhere if somehow or other we do manage the act? And by we, I mean not Britain, which is less dependent, but Europe in particular, if we manage the business of substitution?
Russia mainly sends gas to Europe. So Europe does have a big leverage here. More than 40% of Russian gas goes to Europe. And there is no way to divert it to other suppliers simply because there is no pipeline infrastructure. There is a lot of talk about China, that Russia can quickly switch to China. That is not the case at the moment. There is one pipeline that is still in design. It's a Power of Siberia 2, but there is only a memorandum of understanding between Beijing and Moscow. So at the moment, Europe does have a leverage here.
Tyler, this is simply not a problem that America faces, is it? It just has very little dependency on Russian energy, and so it can afford, in a sense, to kind of talk a lot about it, but it's the Europeans who would actually have to do the doing.
Well, exactly. I mean, if you look at how much trade the U.S. and Russia do, it's less than 0.1% of U.S. GDP. So it's very easy for the United States to say, we're not going to take any imports from Russia. They don't take any right now. Their main source of leverage is banks in New York work to clear the international energy markets that are denominated in dollars. And so if Biden was to tell the banks in New York, you're not allowed to clear this, that would be a problem. But I mean, other than that, the U.S. just doesn't have any significant relationship with Russia.
Tom, there's a judgment call to be made on this. And essentially, it's this really, which is, will Europe move out of a degree of energy dependence on Russia and take the hit, which will be coming its way as a result in terms of higher prices? And also the hit that we will take in terms of higher prices because of what will be happening on the oil markets and so on. Do you think this has been factored in by the people taking the decisions?
I suspect it has, although they haven't communicated it well, I must say. I mean, I don't think I've seen much commentary on the pain that the UK citizen or the EU citizen will have to take at a time when we have a cost of living crisis, we have energy prices rising already quite enough. So I do think there's going to need to be communication from the government on this, because as I said earlier, the only way these sanctions will be effective is if we are willing to accept a degree of self-harm.
Maria, do you agree with that? Do you think that this is now the moment when governments are going to have to spell out to populations, look, this terrible thing has happened in Europe and it's going to require sacrifices from you, the people?
This is exactly what's happening coming from London, from Washington, that there is an explanation to ordinary people in other countries that this is a necessary step because the stakes, as I said, quite high. We need to prevent war in Ukraine, in Europe.
Now, at the top of the programme, we heard Professor Jones argue that sanctions frequently don't work. But the when they, and we're talking about in achieving set objectives, but when they do, it's because they're coupled with other factors. And in South Africa, that was the existence of an organised and powerful opposition in the country being sanctioned and an economic reliance on the country's imposing sanctions. Tom, do you agree with that analysis?
Yeah, I do. And we can sort of say already that sanctions haven't worked in the context of this crisis because they were threatened and the deterrence failed. Sanctions always have to be used in concert with other tools. The question in this case is, you know, what will those other tools need to be?
Well, OK, let's talk me through a few of the possibilities.
Well, I think, you know, who is going to change Vladimir Putin's calculus other than himself? I think if anything will, it will be those close to him. So I think we are right to go after the individuals who are close to him. Those individuals have benefited from being close to him. We need to change that. We need them to realize that it is a disadvantage. There is no advantage to being close to Vladimir Putin. There is no advantage to him continuing to occupy the Kremlin. That is a distant hope, but that, I think, has to be one of the areas that we focus on very closely.
Tyler, do you broadly agree with that?
Yes, I was just going to say I'd like to echo Tom's sentiments quite strongly that one of the ways the UK in particular can put pressure on Putin is by expelling these oligarchs. They love to live their London lifestyles. They love to drive their limousines. They love to eat at fancy restaurants. I'm glad that we're telling the Russian state airline that they're no longer allowed to fly here, but I want just one more flight. I want to send all those guys back to Moscow, and I want to send them back economy class.
Now, okay, we all want to do that. Will we do that?
Well, I think that's a much lower cost thing when you look at we're concerned about energy markets and we're concerned about the cost of living crisis. I think cutting Russia's energy supplies off from Europe would cause problems, whereas telling these oligarchs they're no longer allowed to, you know, spend their ill-gotten gains at Harrods wouldn't. And so I think that's a key part of the UK's platform in particular that needs to be implemented.
Maria Shagana, you're Ukrainian. I'm going to ask you to take a step back from what you might feel about the situation to analyse it. One of the things that could alter the basis of calculation, it seems to me, is if Vladimir Putin decides not just to hand these so-called breakaway republics over to the Russian-backed rebels, but actually to install a puppet regime in Kiev, which is more to his liking. If that were to happen, do you think that over a long period of time, he would meet significant popular resistance? Is that your analysis?
Unfortunately, I would agree with you that this is that Putin is not prepared just to stop in the Donbas region after his speech a couple of days ago. It's clearly that he is not contained with the Ukrainian identity and statehood, so he is launching a full-scale attack on the Ukrainian government. The Ukrainians have been in the state of war for the past 8 years, so there will be a lot of resistance on the ground, guerrillas war potentially. But I think it's important, going back to the previous questions, whether sanctions work or don't work, I think it's important to have some constraining factors. We're not talking about changing his mind or calculus in a deeper sense, but if we can constrain him with sanctions and weaken his economic base of his country, that is a success.
Thank you very much. That's all we have time for. My thanks to Lee Jones, Maria Shagana, Tom Keating and Tyler Kustra. Thanks for listening. Goodbye and keep safe. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Rosamund Jones and Kirsty Knight. The sound engineer was Rod Farker. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon. And if you found it useful, you may find other episodes interesting, including Is the PM's Office Fit for Purpose? What does the government's white paper mean for levelling up? And what are the options for how the BBC could be funded? You can find them all on BBC Sounds.
Here we go, OT. 5, 6, 7, 8.
Dance. It has the power to connect. and to entertain. And in a new series for BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, I explore the iconic dancers who have been doing just that.
Dance, it really, I think, saved my life.
Join me, Oti Mabuse, as I delve into the lives of the innovators and the mold breakers who have changed dance forever.
Gene Kelly was this working class guy that I just really connected with that.
Oti Mabuse's Dancing Legends on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumors, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dawati, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.